Asshole Court is a bi-weekly podcast in which a group of lifelong friends choose a controversial public figure and examine their history through available public records and various publications to determine if that person is as much of an asshole as the general public suspects.
We rate the subjects on a not-so-scientific scale, ranging from Mr. Rogers to Hitler, 1 to 11, and average out the three scores in the end for our final number.
Just a reminder, our judgment has no legal weight, is strictly an opinion, and is subject to change at any time, especially in the case of new evidence. It shouldn't be taken seriously, so just don't.
In 2006, Dos Equis Beer began a marketing campaign that featured a tanned and weathered bearded man. He was anonymous, only going by the title, The Most Interesting Man in the World. In addition to not giving him a proper name, the ads only hinted at what his life story consisted of, which made him the honorary title holder. Big wave surfing in the 60s, freeing a bear from a trap, deep sea fishing, winning arm wrestling contests in exotic locales, and doing wild billiard tricks for a small audience. The ads exploded and became a cultural phenomenon as Dos Equis beer sales went through the roof. People loved the idea of it. It felt funny, but also sort of possible, right? They weren't saying that this is the richest guy in the world and that's why he's cool. They're hinting at something everybody wants. A life well lived. An interesting life. Something extraordinary. Unfortunately for most of us, the closest we'll get to being the most interesting man or woman in the world is drinking a Dos Equis, or sending a Dos Equis meme in some staff email. Who has the time to do all those things and live a life that interesting? The subject of today's show, that's who. John Law is a name that almost none of you have probably heard of. He lived 300 years ago and is largely known only in nerdy economics and business circles. But trust me, his story is one that is more interesting than most movies and has a larger effect on your life than you probably realize. Is he an asshole? Well, get out your snuff box, unbutton your waistcoat and pantaloons, and take off your powdered wig as we find out and examine a life lived to the fullest on this episode of
Asshole Court.
All right, so before we get into it, I want to give a shout out to the person that recommended the show, which was me, because I remember hearing the story, and for some reason, it struck a chord with me here recently, and I was like, that's a story that, honestly, everybody should at least hear once.
You know, we're about 100 and some odd shows deep into this podcast now.
Yep.
And if you guys haven't figured out by now, Mikey is the intellectual, a.k.a. kind of the dork of the group.
That's true. Master, like monster nerd.
Yeah. So this definitely is his topic. And when he told us he was going to do this subject, yep. I was like, okay, I know this guy. I'll get into this a little bit later, but I was very interested in what you had to say about John Law.
Yeah, that's right. Randy has an economics degree, and so I'm sure he heard this in school.
Sure did.
To some extent, at least. You know, the thing is that you get into, on the economic side of things, it's, you know, that story is one story. But his personal life is the only reason I thought, like, hey, this is worth doing. You know, so anyways, there's no shout out to anybody else except for myself. This is me tugging my own dick. And all of you guys can listen.
P.O.B. Pat on the back.
That's right.
Nice one. Thank you, Mikey. We appreciate your suggestion for this show.
That's right. That's great. And then
that's great, he said.
Let's go ahead and get into our From the Inbox.
Ooh, let's find the letters real quick.
That's right.
Buddy, did you have a letter I think we got delivered to our inbox this week?
Yeah, this was actually a review that we had on the update show that we had.
The update show was a lot of fun. If you guys hadn't listened to the update show, check yourself. And go listen to that right now because it was a lot of fun.
Do it.
So this was written in the style of a father talking to his daughter.
Okay.
A conversation. And the review goes, me to teen daughter. The guys on AHC finally bumped Steven Seagal to an 8.12. Daughter, are you having a stroke, Dad? What the fuck is AHC? Steve who? Dad, you know.
Da-da-da.
Daughter, oh yeah. Dad,
Dad of the Year over here. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And who is it from?
That's from Rob726.
Hell yeah, Rob726.
So,
Rob726, yeah. Big shout out.
And
also,
he's teaching his kids good taste.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I do like she knew who we were when he went, da da da.
I know. I'm like, well, we probably should work on our branding a little bit better. We're just the Dun-Dun podcast.
Could be worse.
That's true. We got a couple other ones that were on the most recent show, which was Hugh Hefner. The first one is from, and this is one of the hardest names I've ever had to read because the way they did the text, very strange. It's bookcased by like two X's with wings on it, and I think it says Benny in the middle. It's very tough to read, but anyways, it says, love the Tulsa QT jokes, LMAO. I live just east of Tulsa, and every morning on the news, there's a murder or armed robbery at a Quick Trip. LOL, it's terrible. Lots of love from Oklahoma, though. You guys rock.
Awesome. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, X.
And then we got another one from Manny Hart, which is Manny, you know.
Manny,
something like that. I don't know. But they said that they were up cranking their hog to this.
There you go. Absolutely.
The bodily functions continue. Also, cranking my hog is maybe my favorite euphemism for masturbating. Crank that hog, Manny.
And a perfect one for the Hugh Hefner episode.
And there's a few good euphemisms out there. But
certainly.
Cranking the hog is...
Yeah.
That sounds like an Arkansas...
You think the Razorbacks.
Well, yeah, I think that's kind of where my head was at. But that kind of a Midwestern response.
Well, yeah.
More of a rural response.
I think it's almost like, you know, sort of a very aggressive way to masturbate. You
know, crank the hog.
Crank that hog.
Yeah.
Yeah, so keep it up, dudes. We sincerely appreciate you guys sending that stuff in. And let's go ahead and get the preliminary scores on John Law. Randy, you're up. What you got?
All right. So, as Mikey kind of alluded to, I went to college and I got a degree somehow in economics. So, we did talk about John Law, so I'm not going to bury the lead. John Law is essentially one of the creators of centralized banking, right? So, as you go through all of your economic classes, you learn about how centralized banking works, especially, and kind of how it dictates fiscal policy, and I'm not going to get into the boring stuff like that, but that's where I knew John Law from. I didn't know a lot of the other stuff about John Law. He has, like you kind of mentioned in the intro, Reed, he has a very interesting life outside of just his economic stuff. And I feel as though I have a little bit of a connection to him.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about, you know, tightening up your waistcoat and your pantaloons.
Yes.
I'm a fan of the waistcoat and the pantaloons.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
obviously. He wears them on. He goes, sometimes it's what he wears to work.
That's absolutely right. and I need a powdered wig.
Yeah.
I feel as though that might give me some more tout or clout, as the kids say these days.
Or cloud because of the powder coming off of the wig.
You know what? Good call
there
on that.
There you go.
In the snuff box.
Oh, yeah.
You know what's funny? Snuff is a funny little thing, and I don't mean to get us too far off, but women used to snuff. And
absolutely.
And if you aren't familiar with snuff, snuff is dip.
Yeah.
Snuff is like tobacco dip, but it's very finely ground. It's almost like powder.
Yep.
And they would put for just a little pinch in their lip, and it was like almost you weren't smoking.
Nope.
But yeah, it was just a little pinch of get me up in the morning.
That's correct.
And it seems like it's been making a big comeback here.
It has for
lately.
Some reason.
What?
People are talking.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I swear. Like, not like dipping Copenhagen, but they're like snooze.
Yeah, like the little pouches.
Yeah.
And,
oh, like Zins?
Like Zins, the white ones.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
They dropped it on the weekend update on Saturday Night Live like a few weeks ago where they were like, are you putting more Zins? He's like, absolutely I am. And I was like, what is happening? Huh.
Yeah, I saw it on the Two Bears, One Cave.
Yeah.
Both Bert Kreischer and Tom Segura had them both in and talking about them and stuff like that. And
I guess
wow.
So.
Hey, all right, whatever.
Each their own, man.
Yeah, so, but this guy lived 300 and some odd years ago. So, like, pre-show score, like, without knowing too much about him, average dude. Let's go
4.85 from Randy on John Law. Buddy, what you got?
All right. So for me, I've never heard of John Law before. Mm-hmm. Closest I can get to it is Johnny Law. And I was like, are we going to cover the cops today? You know.
What was the guy from Mortal Kombat? What was his name?
That was Johnny Cage.
Johnny Cage.
Sorry. Yeah. Yep, all right. And so I know nothing about him. I don't have a degree in economics, and but I do like that Mikey was saying that he is he kept on referring to him as the most interesting man in the world.
Yeah,
or,
I'm interested to hear about that.
Yeah,
right?
I'm excited to see what that is going to unfold.
Yeah.
But for me, I'm going to keep it short and sweet. I am splitting the uprights on this because I've never heard him. 5.5.
There it is.
And we'll see where he lands by the end of the show.
All right, sweet. 5.5 for Buddy pre-show. Mikey, what you got for... Jude Law.
Jude Law. Jude Law was in a very good movie called The Talented Mr. Ripley. No, John Law, it's funny because, yeah, I am a nerd about this stuff, and I do go down these rabbit holes. So I was familiar with this guy, and then I don't remember what kind of piqued my interest again when we were
It was about 2 months ago.
Something about that,
something,
yeah.
It was a couple months ago. Mikey, so just peek behind the curtain after the show gets over, obviously, we leave the studio, and we kind of just stand and decompress for 20 minutes sometimes, right? We just sit and talk. And Mikey, we were talking about next show subjects, and Mikey brought this guy up, and I was like, man, I remember him from,
from
college.
Yeah,
like,
but...
Yeah, I knew a little bit about his life, but then I figured it would be an interesting subject to do, and I wanted to do, like, dip a toe and be like, is this worth sort of continuing? Should I do the work on this? And then it was automatic that I was like, oh, this is fucking great. Honestly, to me, it was... Beyond just the economic portion or whatever, it was like the guy's life was just absolutely fascinating. So before all this, I'm just going to put him at a 4.5, just to get the ball rolling.
4.5 for Mikey, pre-show for Johnny Law.
All right. With a 4.85 from Randy, a 5.5 from Buddy, and a 4.5 from Mikey, John Law scores a pre-show asshole score of a 4.95.
All right, 4.95, good territory. Right in between John DeLorean at a 4.93, and in between the upper end of Maury Povich at a 5.02. So in between John DeLorean, the creator of the DeLorean automobile, and Maury Povich falls John Law.
Pretty I think I can see the DeLorean piece. Not Povich so much, but DeLorean.
Yeah, yeah. I think Kid Rock's somewhere in there as well.
That's definitely right. He's at a 4.9. Joe Rogan's in that. Joe Rogan's right around that same ballpark.
Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan's going Christian now, I think.
Is he really?
It's getting weird. Yeah. I read something today where he was talking about we need Jesus back, and I was like, what happened to Joe Rogan that used to just do DMT and watch movies about, like, chimpanzees attacking people?
Yeah, it's the old Joe Rogan, I guess.
All right, you guys ready to create a central bank and do some other shit? I don't know.
Let's kill a man in a duel.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
April 21st, 1671, John Law is born in Edinburgh, Scotland, to William and Jean Law. William was a goldsmith, and Jean, like most women at the time, was a stay-at-home mom. A goldsmith today is simply someone that makes jewelry out of gold or silver, but at this time in history, a goldsmith was much more than just a jewelry maker. William Law, who was, by the way, the great-grandnephew of James Law, who was the Archbishop of Glasgow, well, he was a prosperous Edinburgh goldsmith, a business which then included money lending and banking. So this is from a Planet Money episode on the subject, which I always recommend. Like, Planet Money is just such a good show.
Read it before or watched it before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Quote, during this time, goldsmiths in Britain were kind of becoming banks. What happened was goldsmiths had safes in their shops, so people started storing the gold with the goldsmiths. Goldsmiths started giving people receipts for the gold, and after a while, people started to use the receipts themselves to buy stuff or to settle debts. The receipts were like proto-paper money. They were like money adjacent.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Then the goldsmiths went further. They started making loans. Goldsmiths would give you a claim check for gold that you could go out and use as money, but you didn't have to deposit any gold. Your claim check is for gold that doesn't kind of exist, right? The goldsmith is creating money out of thin air. So if everybody with a claim check came back to the goldsmith and asked for the gold back, the goldsmith would not have enough. To be clear, like, this is basically how banks work today. It's called fractional reserve banking. And similarly today, if everybody with a bank deposit came and asked for their money at the same time, that's called a bank run, and the bank wouldn't have the money.
Yep.
It's like what happened in the Great Depression.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And it can happen anytime now.
There
was
a mini bank run probably 10 years ago.
In 08, people I remember people were panicking and they were talking about you need to go to like Washington Mutual at the time.
Pull all your money.
Yeah, everybody was going there and panicking and trying to pull money. That's what creates a bank run because, again, we're not going to get too into the weeds on this, but effectively a bank has a mandate where they can loan out sometimes like 10 times what they actually hold in cash.
That's
reserves.
Right.
Yep.
Anyways, on the flip side, if your economy, say, like it runs on silver and gold and you are low on silver and gold that you just melted down your favorite chalice, fractional reserve banking is exactly what you need. Anyway, being the equivalent of a bank, William Law acquired a considerable fortune by lending in the Scottish metropolis, which is Edinburgh, and purchased the two estates of Lauriston and Randleston. So I figured Randy would like that.
Oh, nice. Randleston.
Absolutely.
That's, right. That's what you should name your final house, Randleston.
You know, I do have Scottish ancestry. Do you? Part of one of the original clans, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. That's it might be part of my manor.
He said, the problem with Scotland is that it's full of Scots.
Hang on. I need to say it with my eyes closed. It might be part of my manor.
That's right. Your manor with an O. But yeah, so these were properties of about 180 acres in the parish of Cramon and, like I said, the county of Edinburgh. So John Law is born into wealth and pedigree, right? Yep, like he isn't some schlub or whatever. And upon finishing his high school education at 14, which was the norm then, I think, not that he was a super genius, although you all can be the judge as we go on from here.
There was an IQ test the late 1600s.
There was not.
So we don't have another Courtney Love situation on our hands here.
We don't. I would argue, though, that this guy's IQ, if it
probably
was genius
legit,
level, I would say, as we go on, we'll see about that. But anyways, at 14, he enters into the family business, and he specializes in making the finest gold grills in all of Scotland.
Nice.
Hip-hop groups from all over Northern Europe come to him for their tight-ass golds, and obviously that's not true. It's banking. He's doing proto-banking. But right as he's starting in the family business, his dad, William, dies. John is just 17 years old, and the death of his father affects him greatly, as that will tend to do.
Of course.
Whatever. Softy.
Yeah. I mean, come on, man.
My dad died when I was 16.
Yeah.
I was all right.
If anybody can talk about that, it would be Randy, and he didn't even care. I'm obviously joking.
Yeah, I definitely cared.
Yeah, I know.
My dad was awesome, but
your dad was awesome.
Yeah, I remember. He definitely cared.
Yeah, 100%. That was a joke.
I can take it. I'm a big boy.
That's right. Anyways, and perhaps due to the shock, John eschews the family business in exchange for going to London and basically partying his privileged ass off. The thing about John Law, though, is that he isn't a normal ne'er-do-well. He's incredibly smart, and in his school time, he'd spent a lot of time pursuing his interest in mathematics. A lot of his efforts involve the mathematics of probability, and he likes to apply it to gambling.
Oh, hell yeah.
Nice. I'm already liking him already.
Yeah. Me and Buddy are like fucking right.
Additionally, he had developed into a conventionally handsome young man. From a great book on John Law, it was titled Millionaire by Janet Gleason. Quote, by now, he had matured into a strikingly attractive man. Contemporaries euphemistically characterized him as a marked individual. A description of him by a later acquaintance recalled his oval face, high forehead, well-placed eyes, a gentle expression, aquiline nose, and an agreeable mouth. He took such keen interest in his clothes and appearance that his friends dubbed him Beau Law or Jessamy John. With Jessamy was a term back then for a fop or a dandy.
A fop or a dandy?
Yeah.
Dandy boy.
Dandy. Yeah.
Dandy boy.
Exactly.
I like this guy already.
Oh, yeah.
You guys know me. I dress, my wife says that I dress unapologetically me.
Uh-huh.
I have some flair sometimes with my outfits.
Old Dandy Randy.
Dandy Randy dandy a little Randy. Bit.
That's true.
But the fact that he is like a gambling man and he's using his intellect to, Buddy and I love some poker.
Oh, yeah.
And Mikey plays with us because we make him. But,
it's true.
You know.
I'll still play. I like poker.
Oh,
I just
absolutely.
I just don't live for it like you guys do.
Yeah, that's true.
John was also athletically talented. He was good at fencing, which will become important later, and tennis, which had become very popular at the time, which cracks me up. I can't imagine the idea of people in the year 1690 playing tennis.
Imagine the swamp ass going on there.
Oh, dude, yeah. I imagine it was a much softer game. You know what I mean? They definitely were all playing on
it
grass.
It was more like pickleball.
It was probably like pickleball, but
easygoing pickleball.
Yeah, but I mean, you're playing on grass.
It was lawn tennis, is what
it
they
was.
It.
Yeah, it was. I don't even know how that would look, but it was a big deal. Like apparently, it was a very popular game, especially in Scotland.
I do imagine it was a lot like pickleball, very slow and easy.
Pickleball can get pretty intense. I don't know.
I mean, for like advanced leagues, but
yeah, I mean,
go to the 70s plus league.
Oh yeah, it's easy access. You know, it's easier than playing tennis, so that's why it's easy.
That's true.
But I have played a good bit of pickleball, and it can get pretty athletic.
Oh, yeah, they can get pretty intense,
no doubt,
too.
No doubt.
So now, fatherless and young, smart and handsome, he makes London his playground, which, like now, London was a big, bustling city and full of opportunity. Had Frank Sinatra been a popular crooner then, he'd likely have sang London, London in place of New York, New York. If you can make it there, you can make it anywhere.
That's right, baby.
And Law certainly has an interesting time in London. Again, from the book Millionaire. With no father to guide him, John Law, who later confessed that he always hated work, did not attend university, but succumbed to adolescent indolence, happily passing the days in the pleasurable pursuits of gaming and womanizing. There had always been a daredevil strand to his personality, and the risk-taking of gambling perhaps appealed as much as, if not more, than any money he might win. The poker-faced gamesmanship necessary to do well in games of chance must also have become second nature to him. Perhaps it was in these early days that he learned the chameleon knack of playing his cards close, shrouding his feelings, and having the confidence to follow a hunch. With women, his handsome face, sartorial finery, and nonchalant charm apparently combined to yield innumerable easy conquests.
Oh, wow. So John Law was bagging them.
Bagging and tagging.
Yeah.
One of his friends from these Edinburgh days, George Lockhart of Carnworth, said, with a tinge of jealousy, as well as reluctant admiration, that he was already, quote, nicely expert in all manner of debaucheries. Although, frustratingly, he did not record any in detail.
And so nowadays, it would be a TikTok with some random street guy. Hey, what's your body count? And they hold it up to John Law, and he's like,
78 this year.
Yeah.
Holy. Watch this serve. Yeah, I mean, it is, right? But besides being a handsome man about town that fucks for sport, all is not perfect in the life of John Law. See, he studied probability, but maybe because of all the fucking and drinking and whatnot, he's not disciplined. And he ends up with a mountain of gambling debts that he can't fucking pay for. So he reaches out to his mom, Jean. He's like, things aren't going great in London, Mom. Please send money. Now, in all fairness, it seemed like he tried to come up with a suitable arrangement to get her back to whole. But luckily for John, Jean had been conservative with money after William died, and she had a decent bit of money tucked away for when John might fucking suck and gamble his birthright away.
Yep.
So she settles his bets. All good, right? Not quite. Because even though Jean could save John from his half-assed statistical bets, she couldn't save him from his Lothario dick and the problems it would cause. As a notorious cocksman, it was going to be impossible for Law to avoid drama. The year is 1694, and Law has apparently been playing the skin drum with one Elizabeth Villiers, and she was definitely some top-tier booty, okay?
That's right. She was the gal about town.
That's right. She was probably more well-known at this point as the side piece of none other than William III. You know, the fucking king of England, Scotland, and Ireland.
Oh, yeah. Damn.
Oh, she's like Kardashian famous in England at that point.
Yeah. Yep. Anyway, with Law allegedly laying pipe to what Bill and Ted would have deemed a medieval babe of epic proportions, not everybody is happy about it. A dude by the name of Edward Beau Wilson wasn't too pleased with it for some reason. So he rolls up on Law in the streets in Bloomsbury Square and is all, I challenge you to a duel. And Law is like, fuck it, son, come get it. And he quickly stabs Wilson right to the heart with a cool-ass fencing move and drops him like Vince McMahon drops turds on random sex partners, okay?
He did. Wow. This dude dropped him with a single shot. Yep. They said they dueled up, they turned, squared, and attacked, and homeboy had the fencing background.
That's right.
And stuck him literally right one shot right through the chest into the heart and killed him.
Step through the heart, you're too late.
Johnny Law killed a bad mate.
That's right. Wilson dies in the street, and everybody standing around is like, world star!
World star. Yeah.
Now, the thing is, dueling was not only accepted at this time, but actually well-respected when it came to the wealthy class, to the aristocrats.
I'm waiting for the explanation of what happens next.
Yes, it's coming.
Yeah.
Trouble is, Wilson's family isn't exactly cool with a duel ending like it did. I mean, their kid died, right?
Yeah, he's dead.
But he was the one that challenged him to the
duel.
That's
right. Yeah. And it was legal, right? So
they're rich and they have connections, so that's not good for Law. He gets arrested and stands trial at the Old Bailey, where he appears before the, quote, infamously sadistic hanging judge, Salathiel Lovell.
So that was my question. Like, so dueling is legal. They participated in a legal action in which the guy died,
yep.
which is the end result of most duels.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went to jail for murder.
Yep.
Or got tried for murder.
I know that there used to be like contentions on duels sometimes when like maybe one guy would hold back a shot or something like that. And like the other guy would shoot first. And then you're just sitting there staring at, you know, like yeah. a bullet coming at you. But everything seemed to be pretty legit in this case.
I think it was, well, we're going to get into this, but largely speaking, dueling was accepted, but I don't think it was legal. It's sort of like...
Accepted by the wealthy class, but not necessarily legal on the books.
Correct.
It's like decriminalized weed.
Yeah, exactly. I honestly was about to say that. It's yeah. like, if they choose not to prosecute, everybody's like, you know, fuck it. Yeah. Which at one point, like, and I've told this story before on the show, but I remember when I lived in Honolulu and I went to lunch and saw a guy get knocked the fuck out in the street, and it made my day. It made my whole lunch. It was so great because the guy, first of all, was an asshole. Now imagine being 1690 and instead of seeing a dude get knocked out, you see a guy get stabbed through the heart on your lunch break and you're just like, what the fuck?
That Damn. Made my day.
Yeah. Man, y'all should have seen it. I went back to work. Everybody there was like a 60-year-old woman. I was so hyped up. They didn't care at all. In fact, they couldn't understand why I was so excited for seeing somebody get knocked out. So whatever.
World star!
Yeah.
But like I said, he goes in front of the infamously sadistic hanging judge, Salathiel Lovell. And Lovell is like, I rule that we hang this dude. Like, these nuts. Biatch! Because Lovell had been listening to Dr. Dre's The Chronic on the way into the office
right.
and was inspired. The audience was like, ooh, yeah. Saved by the Bell style. The thing here is that apparently back around this time, it was fairly common practice for a family to pay a judge for a specific outcome.
That's what I was thinking when yep. you said all this.
So like I said, even though dueling wasn't a big deal really, Wilson's family pulled some levers and, you know, this is the outcome. But Law's family also has some levers to pull, and so they do, and his sentence is knocked down from death by hanging to a fine.
A fine.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah.
Fine. He went from being on death row.
Yeah.
To paying a fine.
That's correct.
Not even probation. Probation wow. wasn't even a thing then.
No.
Not even like 2 years in jail or anything.
Yeah. No. He killed that man. He drove a sword through his heart.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like murder, not even down to manslaughter, just down to
that's
a
fine.
Talk about like a Netflix special to kill nowadays. Like,
oh, yeah.
Man, this whole story would be just a Netflix badass special.
That's true. Yeah. He'd be the Tinder Swindler, but cool.
Yeah, or Tiger King.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Actually, that's like a wild swing, though. Like, imagine going from an execution to a traffic ticket for manslaughter, yeah. basically, right?
Yeah.
But that's how shit worked back then. So Law is released and relieved, but Wilson's brother's like, I've got one trick left, and he pleads with the powers that be to reinstate that hanging. And they arrest Law again. And this time, they're really going to hang his ass. Law is freaking out. Rightfully so.
Yep.
But double jeopardy.
That doesn't exist. Not then. But he devises a plan. From the book, John Law, the Economic Theorist and Policymaker by Antoine E. Murphy, quote, just 2 days before the date of his execution, Law drugged his guards with an opiate, filed through his iron fetters, climbed a wall over 2 stories high, jumped from it, and sprained his ankle in the process. Some friends outside the prison carried him off to Sussex, and shortly afterwards, he took a boat to France.
He fucking drugged the guards, yeah. climbed the wall, had homeboys meet him, mm-hmm. and then took a boat to France.
That's what they say. That's one story. The book also notes that more likely, his freedom was arranged by some high-ranking members of the government of the day with the implicit connivance of King William. So imagine that. You kill a dude who's mad about you blasting out the king's fucking side piece, and then you get sentenced to die only for the same king to make your escape from death possible.
That's insane.
Straight up, fuck the Dos Equis guy. Yeah. John Law is living that most interesting life. You know what I'm saying?
That is crazy. So I've been to the Tower of London,
yeah.
right? And in the grounds there, a lot of very historical, interesting things have happened.
Certainly.
I just imagine, like, the chick that got her head cut off or chased around the square.
Mary,
like,
Queen of Scots?
Yes, they literally take you to the spot
yeah.
where that all went down, like yeah. you kind of see. So I just kind of imagine what it was like to be in
oh,
that
yeah.
that imagine, kind of atmosphere.
The executioner's like, whoops.
Or the fucking drug. The gun, it sounds like something out of like a fucking, out of Naked Gun.
Yeah.
Like a skit movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, the drugs, or the guards get drugged. They're yeah. out. He climbs the wall.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Files well, the bars.
Yeah, and files the bars. Yeah.
At the time, too.
It all
like,
works out.
The aristocracy would be beheaded because they figured that was a more honorable death, and the standard people got hung. I'm like, bro, just you can hang me. I'm not trying. I don't want it. You know, they, you would tip.
But it would be a clean cut. Like, it's supposed to be just quick.
Didn't happen to Mary Queen of Scots. Took them three whacks with her. Yeah, she got up and ran after that first.
She ran around the yard, and they're like, "Where you're standing is where she ran."
Yeah,
and they chased her around the yard with people watching,
with their head like hanging off, basically.
Yeah.
It wasn't clean sometimes. That's why you would tip the executioner, like, make the super clean.
Oh, and
the
soldiers cut.
And they're like,
whatever.
Hey, look in that window up there. That's where the other girl was watching this, and that's where the king was watching this.
Yeah.
Oh, it's wild,
that's
dude.
Insane.
Yeah.
They just go back home. They're like, that was fucked up.
It was fucked up. And then they take you in to see the crown jewels.
Yeah.
It's like right next to the door where you go see the crown jewels of England.
Anyways, on to this.
That's exactly right.
That's right. But like I said, we're just getting started with John Law's life, right? At this point, he escapes. He settles in Amsterdam, just happy to be alive at this point. But what is a handsome, intelligent coxman that hates to do work? What is he going to do to sustain himself? Well, he decides it's best to get better at gambling.
Hey,
attaboy.
So he does. From the book Millionaire, he became circumspect, almost academic in his approach to gambling. He studied various newly published pamphlets detailing theories of probability. Study in this field had long preoccupied scientists like Girolamo Cardano had studied the science of dice throwing at Padua University in the 16th century and had worked out that the reason it was easier to throw a 9 than a 10 with two dice was a matter of probability. 1 in 9 for 9, 1 in 12 for 10. Galileo had also reluctantly tackled similar problems for his employer, and a century later, new ground had been broken in France when mathematician Pascal was able to explain to his friend Chevalier de Mer that to have a marginally better than even chance of throwing a double six with two dice, he would need to allow 25 throws. One of the first books on the subject was published anonymously in 1662 at a French monastery patronized by Pascal. La Logique de Penser, or whatever, contained four chapters.
What was that, Mike?
La Logique l'art de Penser.
Oh, that was a lot better. Okay.
Thank you. Contained four chapters on probability and was widely translated and disseminated throughout Europe. The Swiss mathematician Jacob Bernoulli, whose Art of Conjecturing, a pioneering study of combinations and analysis of profit expectations from various games of chance, would be published posthumously in 1713, had also visited London at around this time, and Law may have known about his research.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of like heavy hitters
gambling research.
Absolutely. Like the best part was
I've read like a lot of poker books. Yeah. And like this is kind of the early versions of
it.
This.
Is.
Yeah.
It's what's like great he's is learning how to count cards and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's like super system of the 1700s.
100%. Yeah. Galileo did this shit. He got paid, right?
That's reluctantly, what,
that's,
right?
Yeah. his boss was like,
"All right."
Yeah, he was like, "Look, I want to tell you about like the rotation of planets around the sun." And he's like, "I need to know how many times I need to throw these dice to get a fucking 7.
Do I hit on 15 or not? Look, just tell me."
Exactly.
What was Galileo's first name? Johnny?
It was Johnny Galileo.
Johnny Galileo?
Yeah. If you hadn't asked me, what was his name?
Paul.
Galileo Galilei.
It might have been Galileo.
That's it. Yeah. Okay.
So Galileo was his first name.
That's right. Yeah.
He's like Pele.
He is, pretty much. Law's formidable mathematical talents made it easy for him to absorb the science of chance, and he began to try this out, like new skills at the gaming salon. Over games of dice and cards, he taught himself to calculate, often at incredible speeds, the odds in a certain sequence of numbers being rolled at dice or a certain card appearing in the deck. No man understood calculation and numbers better than he did. He was the first man in England that was at the pains to find out why 7 to 4 or 10 was 2 and 1 at hazard, 7 to 8, 6 to 5, and so in all the other chances of the dice, which he began to demonstrate.
Craps. That's craps.
Exactly.
That's I just heard craps.
Yeah, exactly. The approach rapidly paid off, and Law's luck turned. He ceased to be the stereotypical compulsive gambler, addicted to the frisson of gain, but invariably losing. He had mastered the art of risk in much the same way a statistician is able to calculate odds. Betting became a serious business.
So he's kind of like the guy from, I forget his name, Between Two Ferns, that has the meme. Where
Zach Galifianakis with like, the meme where the math is
where
going.
All the math's going on, but it's actually him at the table.
All the best gamblers are doing odds. That's what they're doing,
man,
of course.
And if you look at the greatest poker players, mm-hmm. they are incredibly highly intelligent,
oh, yeah.
just mathematicians.
Yeah, yeah for that's sure. That's what it is. You just know when to play and when yep. not.
You have the early guys that were more like
Chris Moneymaker.
Doyle Brunson, yeah, like yeah. early guys that yeah. were more of a feel.
Betters, they knew people more so.
But then
so.
As you got into the 70s and 80s, it was Eric Seidel, Phil Hellmuth,
oh, yeah.
like just absolute Phil Ivey, like yeah. just Daniel Negreanu. These guys just crush odds.
Yeah.
That's all they do is play numbers.
That's what it
and
is.
And they have a feel for people, too, so that's yep. what puts yeah. them ahead.
Well, is it, if you can sort of read the table, know what you have, and then just honestly calculate what you should bet based on what those odds are, that's all it is. And it's beyond just poker. It's sort of any game, like blackjack and everything like that is how you do a statistical probability.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing watching Daniel Negreanu just sit there and like read everything and be like, you've probably got like Jack 10 right now,
yeah.
and like 9 times out of 10,
yeah.
he hits it spot on.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. yeah. If you can put people on cards, you can read the table, and you know odds, you're pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nevertheless, even a master of odds cannot be guaranteed to win as much as Law seemed to do without cheating or drawing on some other advantage. Law's friends and contemporaries invariably described him as a gambler and either suspected him of card sharping or were simply amazed by his luck. How did he manage it? With hindsight, most biographers now feel that Law's wins were not a result of luck, but of wiliness. His large gains were made when he was able to adopt the role of banker, where the odds were stacked heavily in his favor rather than the gambler. Most of the time, when not playing banker, he was presumably canny enough not to bet excessively. He is also known to have invented his own gambling games, where, again, he could ensure the odds were stacked in his favor.
Nice.
Yeah. yeah. He was basically the house.
Yeah, he was the house. That's
all it
exactly
is.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, they were talking about the
if
game.
If you ever wonder why those casinos are as nice as they are,
yeah.
that's why.
It's
the
true.
House, the odds are in your favor.
That's why, yeah. That's why, you, like, if you're looking at roulette, you're like 50-50. Wrong. Those zero
zeros.
And double zero are there to fuck you
absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely. One
yeah.
out of 32. Yep. That's exactly
just,
right.
Just to push the odds in the favor of the house.
And that's all they need.
That's right.
Yep.
That's right. So he played his game Pharaoh, which was the big game at that time, right? And that's like you would have a banker. And that's when he would, honestly, he would pay, they said sometimes, for the privilege. If he was playing at someone's house, he would pay them beforehand for the privilege of being the banker. And that's when he would just
fair.
Level motherfuckers.
Yes, rush yeah. it, yeah.
yeah.
Here's your flat. I'm going to pay you a flat.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and yeah. then I'm going to rake
yeah.
percentage of every pot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So John Law is traveling around to various countries and playing popular gambling games with members of high society because, remember, at this time, the only people who really had the money and the time to spend gambling were the wealthy and the connected, i.e. people that are engaged in some way to the royal courts of various kingdoms. So John Law is playing cards with the aristocrats and all sorts of different royal courts across Europe, and this is good. Because not only is it a well-paying gig to knock over some dimwit dandies with too much money, it's also a great networking opportunity, which is important. Because John Law, in his more mature years, is about more than just playing cards, drinking, and laying pipe. I mean, he's definitely still all about those things, but he's added another interest to the mix, and that's national monetary policy. And his idea is pretty revolutionary. See, at the time, as we were talking about earlier, all money was backed by gold or silver. And while this created a pretty sturdy peg, it wasn't without some serious flaws. For one, the coins were constantly being adulterated and counterfeited. Or in many cases, people were doing things like clipping, which is shaving the edges off of gold or silver coins while leaving the coins largely intact so they could take all the clippings, melt them down, and create more money.
That's the equivalent of pinching your buddy's sack.
Exactly.
Oh, yep. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Additionally, it wasn't super convenient or safe to carry all of your wealth around you in like gold coins.
Yeah. Imagine carrying around your life savings
yeah,
in your pocket at
exactly.
all times.
Yeah. Which is why people took to goldsmiths like John Law's dad, who became debt issuers. Lastly, gold is largely finite. If your economy falls into a deflationary cycle and you're trying to grow out of that, well, it's tough to get more gold to increase the money supply. So John Law was like, dude, make the state one big old goldsmith, i.e. a central bank. And more than that, don't peg the issued currency to gold, peg it to land and economic output. That way your hands aren't tied when you need them the most. As the economy grows, the money supply can grow and cycle back into the economic growth. At its best, it's a positive feedback loop. In 1705, in between slamming ale, gambling in parlor games like Pharaoh, and slapping skins with any willing wench within groping distance, John Law publishes the economic textbook, Money and Trade Considered, with a proposal for supplying the nation with money. that's the title of the book, to explain his cutting edge idea. And the book is geared specifically to the economy of his home, which is Scotland. Over the next couple of years, his ideas gain some traction in Scotland and it goes up for a vote. One so volatile, apparently, that two dudes on opposite sides of the issue end up having a fucking duel over it.
I was about to say, are they going to duel?
Nice.
They did. Fucking crazy times.
Fencing duel?
I don't know. I just read they dueled over it. It was, yeah, that's how serious shit got.
Yeah. Huh.
Anyway, in the end, Scotland is like, fuck your idea, John Law. We're just going to join England and form the United Kingdom. Sorry about that, you sexy-ass nerd. And John Law is like, y'all are dumb as fuck. I'm out.
We'll see about that. Yeah.
Back to mainland Europe to gamble and fuck and drink and find some people with functioning brains.
I need some backers, goddammit.
That's right. So he does. And he ends up in France, a country that is basically primed for Law's ideas on monetary policy, which is fortunate for him. The country was grappling with severe financial difficulties due to the costly wars of Louis XIV and the mismanagement of finances.
They were in a lot of debt.
They were massive amounts
of debt. Massive debt, yeah. Yep.
France's economy was burdened with a massive public debt and a chronic shortage of precious metals, which hampered the currency's stability and the economy's capacity to grow. At one point, the king had to melt down his silver and gold plates to pay his soldiers, which was kind of emblematic of the bigger problem.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, think about that.
That actually royal China.
It kind of tracks for France, like historically, just kind of
melting down gold plates.
Yeah, just having to kind of roll over and do what they need to do to just survive
until Napoleon.
Yeah. Well, then there was the whole World War II, but that's
We have World War II, but yeah, the Franco-Prussian War, that was a bummer for him. But Napoleon basically cleared house with all of Europe.
He did good for a while to give him a solid fighting name, but
he did.
Other than that, they've been fairly.
You know, in the 20th century, they certainly got beat around. You know, World War I, World War II, Vietnam. Yeah. But previous to that, they had a good run there with Napoleon and also with the Hundred Years' War.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, anyways, so Law is like, I need to talk to the decision maker, which would typically be the king. But by the time Law is cold calling, the king of France is dumb as shit because he's 5 years old. Not his fault. There isn't a five-year-old in history that should be making national monetary policy decisions, but that's what it was, right? Luckily for Law and the rest of France, for that matter, the king isn't allowed to do shit but play with little blocks and whatever French five-year-olds do. In the meantime,
eat croissants.
That's right. Yeah.
Law's trying to trade him dice for access to all the money.
It would be so easy to trick a five-year-old. Like he's got access to the entire country's coffers. You're just like, I'll definitely sell you these marshmallows. In the meantime, the country is run by what is known as a regent. And this was Philippe II, the Duke of Orléans, from the Planet Money Show. So the Duke's hobbies include working in his home chemistry lab, composing operas, and staying up all night with nobles and opera singers and actresses who would all get drunk, sleep with each other, and say, quote, vile things at the top of their voices.
Interesting. Was it
vile things with the tops of their voices?
Vile things.
Oh, vile. I thought you said vile things.
No, like, vile what? Things. Yes, yeah, yes, they'd be like, fuck my butt!
Yeah.
Fuck it! I mean, somebody said that.
I just
French.
Imagine it's kind of a gangbang back then style.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, that's what that was.
Nasty, freak nasty. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I bet you know who the Duke is going to love, and that's John Law.
Yep.
I like to imagine that at a certain point, the Duke of Orléans and John Law did the whole stepbrothers, did we just become best friends?
Well, doing an Eiffel Tower on somebody?
Oh, 100%. Because they definitely became best friends. Gambling together, drinking together, spit roasting some French wench, you know. True Eskimo bros.
You literally took spit roasting out of my mouth. I was going to say, they definitely spit roasted a gal. Over their bonding times.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The Eiffel Tower.
Yep.
That's it.
Is that what it's called?
It is. That's when you high five over her back.
Nice. All right. Beautiful.
Yes. I mean, that happens a lot, and I imagine. And can you imagine being the chick and you're like, well, that's fair.
It is fair. You're already in that compromised position, and you're a willing participant.
Yeah.
A high five's not going to damage the situation anything.
I don't know about you. Oh, man. And having the regent, a.k.a. the king in all practicality, on your side is helpful if you're trying to get some major economic shit done. But the Duke is like, bro, you know you're my bro, but, like, we should probably slow roll this shit because, like, it's pretty pretty radical idea, you know? And Law is like, totes, yeah, you're definitely right. You're definitely right. So the Duke allows John Law to open his own private bank called the Banque Générale.
That's right.
And it starts off poorly and is actually kind of mocked. Mm-hmm. Like, people are like, this is a stupid-ass idea. Whatever. More than that, five of the wealthiest people that stood to lose the most with the bank's success sneakily deposited a massive amount of money in the bank with the idea that after Law had lent multiples of that deposit, they would swoop in, demand their full deposit back, and create a run on the bank and torpedo it.
Yep.
So they did. And Law is like, fuck.
Yep.
Damn it. Didn't see that one coming.
He said,
he might have even seen it coming, but still was willing to take the risk.
Yeah. He said, give me 24 hours to, have my people count it out and stuff, okay? I'll have it for you tomorrow. And he gets on the phone and he's like, Duke, gotta call in a favor, bro.
Yep.
The next day, at the start of business, a royal carriage arrives at the door of Banque Générale and carts out the entirety of the deposit in fat-ass gold bars. And everyone is like, oh, snap! Banque Générale has it like that?
Yep.
And they do. The government of France has just shown its hand, and it is willing to back Banque Générale as a lender of last resort.
Damn.
Yeah. Shortly after that, upon Law's request, the Banque Générale is nationalized and becomes the Banque Nationale. And Law is at the head of it.
That's right. And they put, it was a ton of land deposits and mm-hmm. National funds mm-hmm. into this account that yep. just kind of built the equity in the account up.
Legitimized it.
To where you could legitimately borrow against it and lend correct. Against it to earn interest. Yeah. And
it wasn't pegged just to gold anymore. It was like, okay, we have all of this, all yeah. of this property
yeah.
that if we need to, we could liquidate it. But, you know, whatever. It's a game changer.
Yeah.
It really is. So is that meaning that at this point, he's effectively formed the French Central Bank, and he's the chairman. And this sets him up for the next big venture. And that's running one of the first multinational state-backed corporations in history. Convinced he could elevate France to unparalleled economic prosperity, he took control of the Mississippi Company in 1717, envisioning it as the linchpin in his grand economic scheme. The Mississippi Company initially focused on trade with French Louisiana, rapidly expanded under Law's vision. It secured a monopoly on trade outside of Europe and absorbed the entirety of France's debt, setting the stage for an ambitious economic experiment.
Think about that. He took on the country's entire debt.
Yep.
And he knew he could pay it back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. His system was working.
Yeah. Yeah.
Think about the national debt of the United States right now.
Yeah.
Imagine if some dude came along and was like, imagine if I could solve your debt mm-hmm. and turn us profitable in a few years.
Yeah.
I mean, and at that's that kind of what he did.
Yeah, and at that time.
On a scale was much smaller.
Yes, but still, it's still a huge, especially that time, because this is a brand new idea, too.
It absolutely is. And it seems very kind of elementary to us, right?
Now, yeah.
Like you get a home equity line of credit. That's mm-hmm. you borrowing yeah. against your house. Mm-hmm. That is essentially kind of the same thing he was doing, was he had all the government's land and, yep. and valuable equities
yep.
in an account that he could borrow against. And yep. he was in charge of it, and homeboy yeah. made out quite well.
Well, yeah, and so in addition to all the stuff that's in France, the companies that were sort of state-run, and this wasn't the first one to do it, you know, the Mississippi Company. You had, the Dutch East Indies Company, which was doing the same thing, which was basically
Silk Road.
Yeah, financing the colonization
yeah.
of other countries, right?
Sure,
of other lands. So to finance the operations and manage France's national bonds, Law initiated the sale of shares in the company. Investors, enticed by the promises of wealth in gold and silver, eagerly bought into the dream, sparking a buying frenzy that inflated share prices. As demand for shares surged, Law ingeniously merged the Mississippi Company with his bank, further intertwining France's economy with the company's fortunes. To sustain the burgeoning system, Law detached France's currency from the gold and silver standard entirely, anchoring it instead to the Mississippi Company's share price.
Wow. The yeah. whole currency?
Whole currency was attached to a stock.
God, your fiat is based off of a yep. stock.
Yep.
Could you imagine if the U.S. dollar was based off of Amazon or Tesla?
Right.
Stock jeez. Value.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. And you're like, there's no diversification here.
Yeah.
But
all of our eggs are in one basket.
Well, I guess he could argue, the argument was like, no, this company represents the entire diversification right. of France's economy. But still,
yeah,
it's very different, right?
Yep. That's very forward-thinking for mm-hmm. early 1700s, it
yeah.
is, right?
Yeah. yeah. At this point, John Law is effectively the economy of France, and it shows. He purchases massive estates all across France, and although it's impossible to know for sure due to the nature of global record keeping at the time, it's probable that John Law is, at that point, the richest man in the world. Potentially the richest to have ever existed up to that point.
Wow.
Wow.
Around this time, he wrote to a friend and noted that more than likely he was the, quote, richest citizen there has ever been.
Huh. He probably owned a lot of France.
Yeah. Like,
technically owned
the physical land.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like any company now, right? When you hear about, like, Elon Musk's or Zuckerberg's wealth, that's because they own a large portion of a massive company, right? Yeah. They're not liquid necessarily, but they're like, hey, I can borrow against this too.
Or
right?
Those the guys over in Saudi Arabia that have all the oil money.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's just stupid the amount of money they have. I mean, and Vladimir Putin, nobody's really sure how much money he has.
They argue that he's probably the richest because it's very corrupt. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
He's basically a gang lord at that point. It all siphons up to the top. Yeah. But when you're dealing with, like, you know, sovereign wealth funds like Qatar or Saudi Arabia and stuff like that, you know, and that's what's happening now, especially in the Middle East, is they know that the clock is ticking on oil, so they're really trying to diversify into a million different things.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, in fact, there's been an
lithium mining.
Well, yeah. Just this week, there was some very serious arguments that Qatar, who met with Bukele, who's the president of El Salvador, who put Bitcoin on El Salvador's balance sheet.
Yeah.
They've all been meeting, and they were at this Bitcoin conference, and so, like, the emir of Qatar showed up to this conference, and everybody's like, they're about to start buying the fuck out of the shit. They're mining. Wow. So it's like they're trying to diversify into a million different things. But anyways, he was wealthier than the king of France, and that is for sure. But doubts about the actual wealth of French colonies begins to surface, and rightfully so. The fact of the matter was that, yes, the Mississippi Company covered an absolutely massive portion of land from Louisiana all the way up to Minnesota. Side note here, the operational beachhead for the Mississippi Company was at the entrance of the Mississippi River in what is now Louisiana. Because John Law was super tight with the Duke of Orleans, he made sure that he got a shout out on the venture, and that location was named New Orleans.
No, oh,
I was
shit.
About to say, yeah, is there the tie on that?
That's what it is. Yeah.
Nice.
And yes, the Mississippi Company had the rights to any and all economic output from that area. And on paper, that sounds like a very promising investment.
I wouldn't be shocked if John Law had a Fleur de Lis tattoo.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He absolutely did.
On his back butt cheek, like Lucky Brand jeans or the jeans you get, like, Buckle, the shop in the mall.
Well, now remember, he didn't go over there. He was like, y'all figure that shit out. I'm staying
in
France.
He never stayed or never went over.
He never went over there. Nah. Why would you? He owns all these massive chateaus in France and has, like, you know.
You're right.
He's not going to. In fact, well, we're about to get into this.
Send me the updates.
That's right. I said it sounds pretty promising on paper, but the reality becomes apparent, at least for that time and economic value, that there wasn't much to be made out of that area. There was no gold. There was no silver. And nobody was willing to move there and create communities and economic landscapes that could be taxed.
It was just a bunch of good jambalaya.
It was just a big old stretch of land. It was an unknown area full of risk and full of disease. Things like malaria and yellow fever and whatever else you get from the fucking bird-sized mosquitoes that inhabit southern Louisiana.
Oh, yeah. The swamp. The humidity.
Oh, yeah. Oh. After a bunch of pioneers die and nobody volunteers to replenish them, the French government is like, send some fucking prisoners, dude. So they do. But a lot of them die, too.
Oh.
And then after a while, someone in the boardroom is like, I think it would be advantageous for the growth of the community to send over families and not just prisoners, you know, so they can, like, have kids who will be stuck there and stuff, right? And somebody was like, yes, brilliant idea. And then they paused for a minute, and then they added, but nobody wants to go. Not even like the adventurer dudes who are normally all about that shit. Families definitely aren't going to go. Then after another long pause, somebody was like, okay, hear me out on this. What if, and I'm just spitballing here, guys, but what if we force marriages between prisoners and prostitutes and made them go over there? And everyone cheered, and the initiative was voted on and passed.
Wow.
Fast forward a year later, and the camps in the Mississippi Company are rife with crime and sexually transmitted diseases. It is not great.
Oh, wow. There was no duels about this one.
The dueling was between, some dude's wiener and a syphilitic prostitute.
Oh.
And as word leaked out about the realities on the ground in the Mississippi Company, which was actually named the Compagnie de l'Occident, or Company of the West, it revealed to the general public that the share price grossly overvalued the company's assets. As the speculative bubble reached its zenith, with shares hitting 10,000 livres, the sudden influx of paper money ignited rampant inflation.
Okay.
I had to do some math to give a crude contemporary valuation on this, and I found that in 1720, the livre was priced at the equivalent of 0.31 grams of pure gold. So the valuation of 10,000 livres in today's money would be 3,100 grams, which is about 110 ounces of gold. Gold price at the time of this write-up is $2,139.60. So one share of the Mississippi Company at its peak would be worth about $235,000 in today's money.
Wow.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The rampant inflation of the paper money pushes everyone back to the bank to exchange the currency for gold and silver. But obviously, there wasn't enough for a one-to-one conversion.
Yeah.
Everyone panics, and the stock price of the Mississippi Company goes right into the shitter. The financial disaster plunged France into economic chaos, tarnishing Law's reputation and ending his ambitious economic experiment. The space where the stock had been traded in the streets of Paris with high levels of excitement in the previous couple of years, well, that gets absolutely flipped over by angry investors who had just lost their asses. Like, they fucking torched these tables and shit where these guys were setting up.
Wow. Jeez, and what's this, like, the King of France is like 10 or 12 at this point or something like that?
Somewhere around that. He doesn't know what's
happening. He's like,
yeah.
But they tie their whole fucking currency to a stock.
Yes.
And if the stock price drops dramatically, mm-hmm. the value of your dollar drops and people are going to want their money because they don't want it to drop anymore.
Well, and as you really read into this, and I didn't want to dive too deeply into it because, like I said, again, I want to live in the weeds on this one. But John Law didn't intend for a bubble to occur with this. Like, he was like, oh, this makes sense. But, like, it created an opportunity where it's like a feedback loop where people are like, oh, everybody's getting rich. Everybody, this is where the word millionaire came from. This is the first time in history where people are like millionaires, like average people were making millions of dollars. And that makes sense because, like I said, one stock today would be the equivalent of like $235,000. You know, these people were coming out of a horrible economy for a long time and everybody fed into this frenzy. So at that point, John Law is really trying to just contain the problem. So he's like, well, let's issue more shares. You know, let's go ahead and do this.
Whatever. Was it borderline Ponzi?
I mean, I think you could call it a Ponzi scheme, except for with a Ponzi scheme, there's intent to do that.
Yeah, but his intent wasn't there.
His intent wasn't there. Yeah. It was an honest effort on his part, and it was also,
it's one of the unintended consequences of the idea.
Well, it is. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because you're just like, okay, this is all predicated on the value of this one company.
Yep.
And, you know, it's, again, on paper, you're like, oh, wow, they have all this land. There's going to be so much stuff. Like, everybody was discovering
they're
gold.
So big, they can't fail.
Exactly. Yep. But this was a different time and
didn't
work that way. His homeboy, the Duke of Orleans, turns his back and is like, John Law, get the fuck out, bro. And Law, having had some experience with the legal systems of Europe and angry people and going on the lam, gets the sense that if he doesn't get the fuck out of the country, he's going to be facing a hanging for a third time. Probably this time by people that weren't like part of the legal system.
Yeah.
No royal carriages are showing up to bail him out this time.
Nah, no. Just some random dudes.
Full vigilante justice.
Yeah.
So he bails, some say, by dressing up as a woman and sneaking out of the country at night, which, to be honest, wouldn't really be all that different than what he was wearing day to day.
Yeah, you talked about waistcoats and pantaloons. And,
the satin pantaloons, high heels, tights, and the large and long 1987 style butt cut perm that all the aristocracy rocked at that point. Throw some tits on him and you'd barely blink.
That's it.
His properties in France are liquidated to pay for his failures, and he lives out his life in Venice after that, where some sources say he died in poverty, and some say he went back to his life as a fairly successful gambler, but definitely no longer the richest man on the planet. I tend to believe the latter.
So he went to Venice, huh?
He went to Venice.
Man.
They were saying that he also had gotten offers from Russia and some other country to come, and they were going to pay him to be like an economic advisor, and he turned it down and instead, like, I think he just cashed out and was like, fuck it, I'm going to go to Venice.
I don't like working. I can go to Venice and gamble.
Yeah. And I don't think this one thing I read said that he died in poverty. I don't think that's the case. I mean, it isn't like you lose the ability to be good at gambling calculations.
And Venice is a very interesting city.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's the city of the canals, right?
Yep.
And I was there last Christmas, and It's a big city, obviously, but it has a very small city feel.
Sure.
So we went on the gondola rides, and they show you Marco Polo's house and kind of all the famous people. Dude, it's all within a quarter mile.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So back in the day, it wasn't that big of a city. So I could see that being a very easy to get around, kind of laying the low light.
Yeah. Yep. Well, and honestly, Venice is where banking comes from.
Yeah.
That's really where it all got started. Like, if you read about the history of banking, it always starts with the Medici's. And, you know, it's whatever. That's why, honestly, like, The Merchant of Venice, the Shakespeare play, is about a Jewish dude that lends money.
Yep, that's exactly right.
So, like I said, I tend to think he probably just kept gambling. You know, he's a smart guy. It's not going to change unless he, like, takes a Moet bottle to the head.
Just didn't have his Royal Vistas anymore or anything like that.
No. Anyway, the story isn't over with John Law, because the reality is the failure of the French government and the financial collapse of the Mississippi Company adds to the general disgruntlement of the French populace, and rightfully so. And a lot of historians will trace a straight line from the economically disastrous policies of King Louis XIV, you know, Versailles wasn't fucking cheap, to the Mississippi Company fiasco, to the French Revolution, where King Louis XVI gets his fucking head lopped off, and the Reign of Terror campaign, and the rise of Napoleon, all the way to the offloading of the territory to the United States for just a little bit of cash.
Yeah, was it $3 million?
Something along those lines. Very cheap.
$3 million, yep, jeez, that we bought Louisiana for.
Yeah, the Louisiana. And it wasn't just Louisiana.
Tommy J got that one negotiated for us.
Yeah. It was the whole Louisiana territory,
which is
much larger. So in that sense, if you're listening to this podcast in any of the following states, Arkansas, Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Minnesota, Louisiana, New Mexico, Texas, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, or Colorado, you can thank John Law's hard-drinking, sword-fighting, odds-making, risk-taking, wench-slaying, ladder-climbing ass for your current citizenship status as an American.
I didn't realize it was that big.
It was massive. Yeah. It actually ended up in Canada, too. I didn't even...
Yeah, it did go up to Canada.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was $3 million, I think, we paid for it.
We got it for nothing.
Nothing.
Got it for a song.
Jefferson negotiated that deal, I believe, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely the president when it happened, and they were just like, we need some money.
Yeah.
And then we were like, we'll take the whole... Plus, at the time, remember, you have to think from the French side, they were like...
They weren't getting anything out of it.
Exactly. Yeah. They were like, fucking unload this thing.
Whatever. Yeah. It's a depreciating asset. Yeah.
Exactly.
And how long would it take to get from France to there back in that day?
You know? Yeah. A lot of effort.
If they had found gold or something, they never would have given it up for that price, but they thought it was only... Now, as it turns out, it ended up being the breadbasket of the entire country, amongst other things.
Yeah.
But that's it. John Law, final scores, boys.
Interesting story, Mike.
All right, Randy, what do we got?
So, I mean, you think about the most interesting man in the world. Mm-hmm. This guy lived a tale that matches, I mean, very few. Run through the courtroom. I mean, just the life the guy lived. The part about him I liked the most was his gambling aspect.
Yeah.
And we've talked about my love and Buddy's love for poker.
Mm-hmm.
We play cards a lot, man. We play a lot of poker, and we're all into it. We love going to casinos, and we have a great time when we do it. So, I mean, I have a little affinity for his love for gambling there.
Sure.
But in terms of asshole, he did kill a dude.
He did. Although that dude stepped up to the plate.
He stepped to the plate and offered to be killed.
He did offer him up. He didn't know that really good at fencing.
Nah. He did kind of throw France into a financial turmoil
for
a while. But being a man of the times, I can't hold the body too much against him.
Yeah, no, that was just what was going on.
You know what? And I'm thinking of this guy, and I'm thinking Hulk Hogan. So my final score is going to be a 6.03.
6.03.
Just below Hulk Hogan is my final for John Law.
Okay. 6.03 from Randy on John Law. Buddy, what do you got?
All right. So, very excellent pick.
Oh, thank you.
Mikey, I enjoyed this story very much.
On the surface, I said.
Oh, we cringed.
A lot of people are going to be like, oh, fuck.
What the fuck? Yeah. I hope they actually, they see it and they're like, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, he definitely was one of the most interesting men of the world. I mean, he was one of the first richest guy in the world.
Right?
At a certain point. Arguably, he was the richest man that had ever existed up to that point.
That's insane.
From a dude that literally was just like to fuck and drink and gamble.
Didn't go to college, just graduated high school at 14.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's insane.
He does have a body on him, but it was, like we said, a sign of the times more so. It wasn't like he went out and actually murdered somebody.
Right.
Well, he did, but, you know.
Not with intent. Like, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. I feel like it was self-defense.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean. It was like, a duel.
You went the dude showed up and was like, let's get it on. And he was like, stab!
Yeah. He was, got your ass. Yeah.
He was racing for pink slips with his life.
Yeah, totally. Totally was.
Yeah.
So, you know, originally, as the story was going through, I was thinking of kind of Dan Bilzerian a little bit. Like, he's kind of like that newer guy that he's not as rich, but he is very rich. He likes to play poker. He bangs all the chicks, you know. I was
he
seeing
pays chicks to bang.
Yeah.
And honestly, I don't even think he's that good of a poker player, you know what I'm saying? And he certainly isn't sitting there thinking about, like, national monetary policy as a side gig.
Or creating a central bank.
I've got this novel economic theory. Instead, he's, like, running around to the country be like, give me that gun!
I need Viagra.
Yeah, that's why I couldn't put him up there with him. And besides, Dan's up at like a 6.58, and I don't think that we can put John Law all the way up there.
Yeah.
For me, I'm going to put him up there with,
is he like Jake Paul?
He is kind of like Jake Paul. Or maybe even, I think for me, he kind of has a little bit of crossover with Tony Robbins.
Tony Robbins.
What the fuck are you talking about, buddy?
Well, I mean, like, he's a good-looking guy who can who's very persuasive.
All right, I'm buying this so
and
far.
And can, you know, he's got a lot of money. So,
he closed me. All right.
You know, I'm going to put him up there with Tony Robbins.
There
I'm
it is.
I'm going to put it at a 6.19.
6.19, buddy's final score. Mikey, what you got? Final take on John Law.
Yeah, I genuinely like this guy. I can't help it. Like, it's honestly, like, in my mind, like, obviously, I think he had a good idea that just was, again, the old saying is pioneers get slaughtered. It's real.
Sure. And if you believe in
the door.
And if you believe in reincarnation, this guy could have come back as like Daniel Negreanu or something.
Yeah, if he wanted to focus on poker, he'd have been amazing.
Yeah.
In fact, he did, because remember, he started playing, was like kind of fucking around, lost all his shit, and then had to escape after he killed the shit out of a dude and was like, what am I gonna do? I don't really like to work. Like, I'm gonna get better at gambling.
Yeah.
And he fucking did.
Yeah.
Got so good at gambling that he was just like knocking dudes over in royal courts all over the country. And was apparently such a likable dude that they just like immediately liked him and hung out.
It was
out
like
with
Doyle
him.
Brunson. Doyle Brunson and Amarillo Slim were invited to all the cash games around Texas because they were respected. They knew they brought a good game.
Yeah.
Those guys sat and toured Texas. Doyle Brunson was a school teacher when he started playing cards. And then about 3 months into it, he brought home a year's salary in one night to his wife, and she was like, all right.
You've got a new profession.
You can go do this now. Yeah.
And that's what, like, eminently likable dude. Even, like, his buddies were like, that dude fucks. For real. You know, like I said, athletic.
That's kind of how we think of you, Mikey.
I appreciate it. I'm nowhere near as smart as this guy. Nowhere near as smart as this guy. You know, but I honestly just can't help but like the guy. What's funny, too, is like when you have these conversations in like the economic world circles, like Austrian economics people like hate this guy. They're like, he's Satan. He introduced fractional reserve lending or whatever.
Yep. And it doesn't add up. It doesn't equal both sides of the ledger.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And I'm like, well, look, and for me, I'm like largely agnostic to the idea. I'm like, it does sort of make
sense
for what
you need.
You
have to have the confidence in the people that they're not going to make a bank run. That's how fractional banking works.
Exactly. Yeah. And so aside,
but you have to have enough confidence in your total economy for people to believe in you.
Yeah. So, I think on paper, his idea made sense. And then like, I don't think he anticipated people getting speculative and wild, right? Like Tulip Mania.
They tried to undermine him. They legitimately tried to fuck him that one time.
For
where
sure.
They showed up with
initially
a fucking carriage full of gold.
That was
a fucking pull my dick out and show it to you.
That was
moment.
A flex.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine standing out there when that royal care and those guys are like, oh shit. Because their scheme didn't only not work,
they
it
lost
blew
money
up
on
in
it.
Their face.
Yeah, they lost a lot of money on it.
The entire banking system changed in that one moment for France. Everybody's like, oh, shit.
Well, then everybody saw how France was making money on it, and they decided to go with it.
Yeah.
Well, and that's how it started.
Even though the idea failed, and largely a lot of like economics books will say it's not necessarily his fault as it was just like a speculative bubble that you couldn't really anticipate. His ideas were still well-respected enough that other countries were like, hey, we still want your idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
Come over here and like maybe you can. And he was just like, nah, I'm going to just go to Venice and just gamble.
I don't like to work, so I'm going to go gamble instead.
Yeah, I feel like, I was like, I wish I could be as cool as this dude.
That's what I'm saying. You go to Venice and it's easy to escape. Mm-hmm. Seriously. Like, yeah. You can get in one place and out of one place and in a pretty protected area across water very quickly. Like, yeah, it's easy to get around.
I don't feel like he's a large asshole because, again, the guy he killed, that's a duel. The dude brought it to him. And I was like, you just take care of business, I guess, at that point, right? And then also to have that duel because you're slamming the king's side piece and then the king helps you escape.
That's what's really crazy.
Well, the king probably recognized his value to what he needed to have happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like legendary shit. He ended up getting pardoned later on. And he could come back to whatever. So anyways, for John Law, I just have him at a 5. I think he's a nice, I mean, I'm not saying nice guy. I think he's a very cool, fascinating historical figure that there should be a lot more on. What was funny was when I was doing the research, the Wikipedia page is so small.
Doesn't do him any justice.
And the side piece of the king has a longer Wikipedia page than he does.
Interesting.
And I'm like, all she did was fuck her way up the food chain, and this guy like blew up economies.
Central currency. Yeah.
I was very disappointed, so I ended up having to like go through a bunch of books and stuff like that. So 5.0 for me, I think the dude's cool.
There we go. 5.0 for Mikey, final score for Johnny Law.
All right. With a 6.03 from Randy, a 6.19 from Buddy, and a 5.0 from Mikey, John Law scores a final asshole court score of a 5.74.
All right, 5.74. We have a crowded area at 5.75, everybody. We have three people with a 5.75 score just above John Law. We have Vince McMahon, Papa John Schnatter, and P. Diddy, all at 5.75.
Well, hold on. That was original Vince McMahon.
Oh, that's
we
right.
Rescored Vince at a 7.22.
That's right. Yeah. And we should have. You know what? Another thing, too, I forgot to mention. We did kill Toby Keith.
Yeah, we did. Unfortunately, we'll Mikey made the joke about the album. Episode.
And he died.
Yeah. R.I.P. Toby Keith.
Yeah.
So, Papa John Schnatter's at 5.75. P. Diddy's at 5.75. And just below that is Hilaria Baldwin at 5.68.
Yes.
So with a final asshole score of 5.74.
5.74.
5.74. We are just below those two.
Mm-hmm.
So just below Papa John Schnatter and P. Diddy falls John Law.
That's right.
Awesome. All right. We hope you guys enjoyed this episode of Asshole Court. As always, we appreciate all the support. You guys see how much we enjoy the feedback. Please leave us your comments. Give us feedback on our shows. We'd love to hear from you. If you haven't joined Patreon, which a lot of you haven't, and I'm very disappointed in you, go to patreon.com/HC podcast. Join one of our support circles there. The $2 club will get you in and you'll thank us a lot. $5 and $10 will get you into all of our Conspiracy Court episodes as well.
We've got over 30 episodes of Conspiracy Court on there. I mean, that's over like 25 hours worth of material.
Pure debauchery.
That's exactly right. So if you want more AHC podcast, again, patreon.com/AHC podcast. Check it out. We love all of you. Thank you for all the support. Be kind to one another, and we'll see you next time on Asshole Court.